Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Helen Crane. And coming up, house price predictions for next year have started to roll in. So where do the experts think they're headed next? Is it really harder to buy a home now than in the past? And Halifax launches a highly unusual fixed-rate mortgage. Should borrowers be tempted? Also today, how to stay warm this winter without breaking the bank. We reveal the amount you should have saved in your pension in every decade of your life to guarantee a golden retirement. And my new SIM-only mobile deal is free. Kind of, says Lee Boyce. Just make sure you don't stumble into the out-of-contract trap. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, property experts from both Supla and Knight Frank have come out with their predictions for house prices in 2025. But will they, Lee Boyce, prove to be right? What are they predicting? Welcome to you both.
Hi, Georgie. Yeah, so we've had a number of property reports coming out in recent weeks, more so a flurry, I would say, even more so than usual. So this week we've had Zoopla saying that house prices went up 1.5% this year, which is actually pretty good going when you consider that over the course of 2023, they fell by 1.2%. But then in 2022, the growth was at 7.2%. So a real slowdown on a couple of years ago, but better than last year. And what Zoopla is suggesting in this report is that the housing market has turned a corner and buyers are accepting, you know, they're kind of now used to higher borrowing costs. They've kind of got used to the fact that mortgages are kind of 4 to 5%, and they're not kind of moving one way or the other at the moment. They're kind of quite settled in that 4 to 5% bar. We had a bit of a flurry of a mortgage war recently, and that's kind of abated a little bit when we've had some interest rate falls. But now there's, with inflation sort of nudging up a little bit, there's talks of maybe the base rate cuts not being as deep as what was expected. So we're going to see this all kind of filter through into borrowing costs and what banks are offering. We've also had a growth in household incomes that Zoopla points to in support, which has boosted some buyers' budgets. So all that, you mix that all together, there's so many moving parts in the property market, but what that spat out this year is that house prices have nudged up 1.5%, according to Zoopla. They're predicting a 2.5% rise next year, which would kind of suggest that, you know, they're much better than this year in terms of rises. And that's because what Zoopla is saying is that mortgage rates are unlikely to change over the next 12 months. They're predicting mortgage rates stay at about 4.25%. Incomes forecast to grow more modestly, but they have all of this modeling that they use. And actually, one of the modeling techniques that Zoopla has, which I think is quite interesting in this, and it's quite, I wish I could show you the chart. If you're listening to this, I obviously can't describe this chart in absolute detail, but it has a model that tracks whether homes are under or overvalued, right? So in 2007, the financial crisis, house prices were 40% overvalued, according to Zoopla, and then house prices fell sharply in 2008 and 2009. Recent jump in mortgage rates between 2022 and 2023 led to UK homes become 16% overvalued, 16%, which is not as bad as that financial crisis kind of level. But if it had kept going up, you know, you could kind of start to argue, is there a bit of a bubble here? But with sort of slightly lower mortgage rates, it says that it has repaired the overvaluation this year. And actually, looking at this chart, it kind of has leveled out. And they're actually saying it's almost bang on what they should be, house prices. And actually, over the next couple of years, they have this modelling saying that house prices are actually going to be slightly undervalued Which I think is really interesting. It's an interesting chart. We have it in the story. It's worth having a look at. That's what Zoopla are saying. We've had a number of house price predictions also coming in recent times. I think we mentioned this one on the podcast a little while ago, but there was quite a kind of really deep one, really kind of like spicy one, I would say. This is, if I was in the office, I'd be calling this a bit of a spicy forecast for next year. And that was from Savills. Saying that he thinks house prices are going to go up 4% next year. And actually between now and 2029, it actually uprated what it thinks house prices are going to do in this country, and that they're going to go up 23.4% between now and 2029. That's £84,000. That's what they're forecasting. Very hard to forecast 5 years in advance, right, with numerous budgets, with, you know, all sorts of, as I say, moving parts that can affect this. So I always think it's very hard to go a year. Even a year is difficult, but to go beyond that, yeah, okay, it's nice to have a kind of barometer of where we're at, but that's a lot. And the big thing that's going to crunch next year, we're getting lots of people writing in and asking about this, is the stamp duty changes next April. Because, you know, you could try and rush through a house purchase now, but it's getting to that point where it's going to be difficult to get a purchase done and over the line before April 2025, which is when higher stamp duty rates are going to come back in. So, you know, it could add quite a bit. So, for example, on a £425,000 purchase, that's going to be a £6,205 tax bill from the 1st of April. I think that there's been in the last couple of months buyers fully aware of this, and you can get the dreaded C word in the property industry is chain, and if you get yourself stuck in a chain, it can drag on for a very long time. Lots of people, there was a report recently suggesting that searches for chain free homes has just rocketed in the last month or two, because that's what people are looking for. They're looking for a chain-free home more so than a property that might actually be right for them. You know, just to try and get this over the line, to try and dodge a potential hike in stamp duty. And actually, we have figures, Bank of England figures, suggesting that mortgage approvals and the amount of mortgages that have been taken out over the past month has gone up. It's nudged quite a bit higher over the past month as well. So you bubble that all together, all of those things are potentially things that hit house prices, but Zoopla, they've put their nails in the bus. They've gone to 2.5%.
I was just thinking there, Lee, even without the stamp duty changes, the terrible C word can strike fear into even the staunchest of house buyers. I remember we were told, oh, there's no chain with ours. Yeah, and then they went, oh, there's a problem with the chain. And we went, oh, well, that chain you told us didn't exist. Helen, Lee there said about, you know, it's difficult to predict 5 years forward. It's rather difficult to predict 1 year, because I thought that at the start of last year, or this year, I suppose, all the predictions were house prices would fall between 1% to 3%. But actually, it looks like overall we're going to end on a high. How much should we take these predictions? Not that they aren't wonderful and produce wonderful graphs that excite Lee no end. Honestly, I bet he can't wait for the next story. There's a lot of graphs in that one. So how much can we take these sort of predictions, Helen?
I am always a bit surprised that these property companies keep putting these forecasts out every year, because it's a bit like when people predict the results of elections. You know, so much can go wrong and you can look a bit silly come the same time the next year. Honestly, this represents a return to a bit of normality in the housing market, I think. So 2.5% rise next year, if that's correct, that's quite, dare I say it, normal. I know people, for obvious reasons, who own homes love to see their house price kind of going great guns. But actually, we've had such a wild ride in the housing market over the last few years, since obviously the massive boom during COVID. At some points then we were seeing house prices going up 11% year on year. And then obviously it came crashing down after the mini budget in 2022. No one really saw that coming, with obviously mortgage rates spiking. But at the minute, you know, mortgage rates around 4% to 5%, house prices perhaps going up 2.5%. That to me sounds quite normal. So I think maybe we can trust the predictions a bit more this year than perhaps in previous years. It seems to be a return to a bit of stability, which we haven't had for a few years, which, yeah, dare I say, is is possibly quite a good thing.
Whisper it softly, Helen, whisper it softly. All right, so let's talk about the next story. As I mentioned, I teed it up there, graphs and everything, a lot of stats. I can just imagine you're getting very excited about this, Lee. But whenever I talk about how difficult it is for young people now to get on the property ladder, I am usually met, particularly when I'm on air, by a listener or an expert that will argue with me that no, it was much harder in the past. Even though house prices were a lot lower, it was the mortgage rates, interest rates that were so much higher. And that is the argument. Well, broker Mojo Mortgages has been crunching the data all the way back to 1974, when, and I took a look here, the average rate was about 9.2. But you could buy a home for a cool £10,000. Imagine that, eh? £10,000. So, Lee, what were Mojo Mortgages looking at? What did they find? Is it harder now?
It's a really difficult question to sort of tackle, isn't it? Because it's a lot of emotive feelings towards this, and you know, things have changed a lot, and that's the sort of crucial thing to consider. And I sometimes find it sort of like, you know, it's apple and pears, isn't it? You know, what does it matter if it was easier or harder 50 years ago? Really, you know, it's kind of like we're in the here and now. What's the point of looking backwards and sort of, you know, kind of, it's all that generational war stuff that I just...
A fair point, Lee.
I try to avoid at all costs. But this is still interesting in terms of, there's a great infographic on this that we've had made up. And I think I'll talk through the infographic is probably the best way to do this. So the average property price in 1974 was £10,027. And in 2024, £265,012. That's based on nationwide figures. That's a difference of 2,500% or £254,985. Now, I think actually more crucial than that, than the fact that property prices have gone up that much, is the deposit amount. So if you just take that figure there that I said, 2,500%, the average deposit in those in that 50-year period is up 10,757%. So much bigger mortgage, but much bigger deposit now, typically required, which will be down to numerous things, but probably the number one thing to point out here is stricter criteria for mortgage lenders. You know, they got burnt. We talked about financial crisis just a minute ago in that Ziegler story. You know, there was a lot of people that got burnt on, you know, interest-only mortgages, for example. So anyway, deposit amount, 1974, £537. In 2024, £58,000. So that's that 10,757% difference. I should point out here that you don't necessarily have to find a deposit that big. If you take that £265,000 and you set a 10% deposit on that, you're talking 26k. And there are a number of mortgages available for first-time buyers with 5% deposit, which would take that down even lower. But this is an average of what people are putting down as a deposit. So deposit as percentage of property price was 5.36% in 1974. That was the overall average. And today it's at 22%. And deposit as a percentage of two people's salary was 15.05% in 1974. It's 86.65% today. So that's that's the rub for me. It's not the house price. It's not property prices. The growth of property prices. We talk about the barrier of entry when it comes to deposits. I think they are figures that show you how difficult it is to get a deposit saved. Because even in these stats, they say time to save for average deposit in 1974 was 3 months. Average time to save for a deposit now, 11 years and 3 months. Which I think, to me, that seems like a bit of a stretch. I think 11 years is quite... I don't know where they've taken that figure from, but that seems like a hell of a long time. Average age of first-time buyer was 26 in 1974. It's now 33 years and 8 months. That's 7 years and 8 months older now. So we are buying our first home a lot older than we were in 1974. So you mix all those things together, and we'll go back to the original question of, is it harder now to buy a house than it was in 1974? Well, I think I'll take John Fraser Tucker here, who's the head of mortgages at Mojo. He said, our analysis has made it clear that today's first-time buyers are navigating a much tougher landscape than those who entered the market in 1974. He said, however, despite these daunting statistics, there's a silver lining. First-time buyer activity was up 21% this year compared to the previous year, and this increase suggests that many are finding ways to make homeownership dreams a reality, even amid rising costs. That's the thing, isn't it? You know, it's kind of easy to say, yeah, house prices have gone up, you know, X, Y, Z. You know, if they've gone up by inflation rate, it wouldn't be anywhere near as that. Salaries haven't grown as fast as house prices. So since 1974, we've got a figure here saying that individual salaries are up 1,791% since 1974. That hasn't kept pace with property prices, and that's definitely not kept in pace with deposit amounts, according to this research. But if you do want to buy your first home and you can get that deposit together, you know, it's you kind of got a lot of options, I would say, I would argue, in terms of mortgages and property stock.
So that's it, Lee. You highlighted the rub there. You know, when we do say, oh, it's harder now, you know, house price so high, etc. But Helen, like Lee said, people are finding a way. How are they doing it?
You're right. People are finding a way. One thing that I found really interesting from this research, it just kind of shows how times have changed. Obviously, as Lee has just explained, yes, it was a bit easier to get a mortgage based on your salary back in 1974. But one thing that people were saying in the comments was that there was a lot of women in the comments saying, actually, well, yeah, it was easier, but when we got our first mortgage, they wouldn't take my salary into account. Often they wouldn't even take the woman's salary into account because they thought they were so likely to go off and have a baby. You know, things have obviously completely changed today. So, you know, we do have more couples where both people are working, you know, both people are bringing a salary, which sort of technically makes things easier. But then obviously house prices are so much more expensive. I think there was things that were difficult back then. There's things that are difficult now. Obviously affordability is a huge challenge. And I think, you know, people live very differently in 1974. If you look at the typical city now, look at London, a lot of people who are buying their first home, they're buying a flat. They're buying, if you look at how many houses there are in London and that are now converted to 2-3 flats. And, you know, that's a typical first time buyer property. Whereas back in 1974, more people would be able to afford to buy a whole house to themselves. You know, people today will rent for longer. They'll share a house with other people when they're, you know, first working and first starting to save. And, you know, all of those things were less common back in the 70s. So I think it just shows first-time buyers will, that they'll find ways to make it work. You're right that a lot of people do have support from their family. And I think that's something that's, you know, increasingly, I don't want to say necessary because not everyone has it, but a lot more people are using that help because, you know, it's incredibly difficult. And for some people, there's just simply no other way. You know, if you're not in a particularly high earning job or if you live in an area that where house prices are extremely expensive, you know, if you're offered that support, you will use it. I think people are obviously taking larger mortgages is something that's necessary for a lot of people. People in this country at the end of the day just really, really want to get on the housing ladder, obviously partly because renting is so difficult and so expensive, and I think people will just find a way.
Meanwhile, Helen, sticking with house prices and mortgages, last week we discussed, I believe it was last week, Helen, whether to fix for 2 or 5 years. What about 18 months? Halifax is launching, yes, a 1.5-year fixed rate mortgage deal in response, they say, to growing demand. I mean, why would they release it if no one wants it? Among borrowers for shorter term deals. But who, Helen, are these borrowers? And is it a good idea? How unusual is an 18-month fixed deal?
It is very unusual. So Lee described this to me yesterday as a weird mortgage. It is a very weird mortgage. You hardly ever see 18-month fixed mortgage deals. 2 years is normally the minimum that you'd be required to fix, or 5 years, also popular, and you can get mortgages longer than that as well. It is really unusual. And I think the reason why Halifax has brought this out is because there is this expectation amongst some people the interest rates are going to go down quite substantially over the next year, year and a half, couple of years. Obviously, as we've said on the podcast many times before, that's not for sure, but a lot of predictions are still suggesting that rates are headed down. So this mortgage is aimed at people who think that rates are going to be going down, and not even in the next 2 years, but in the next 18 months. So the idea is that you would fix in for this short period with the hope that once that finishes, you'd be able to fix in at a lower rate. It does. So the rate on it, on this mortgage, is 4.37%. So that's for someone with a 40% deposit or equity. So that's just a bit more expensive than the cheapest 2 year fixes you can get. They're around 4.27%, 4.3%. It does come with a fee of £1,499, which is really high. So one thing to consider is, obviously, every time you fix your mortgage, you don't always have to pay a fee, but often you have to pay a fee. So do you really want to be paying that fee now and then paying it again in the next 18 months, especially if you're rolling the fee into your mortgage? That can add up. But if you are really convinced that rates are going to fall, and they're going to fall quite soon, it could be the product for you. Also might work for people who perhaps have a bit of a life change on the horizon, someone who's absolutely convinced that they're going to move in the next 18 months, so they don't even want to risk a fix for 2 years. This could be a good stopgap. People who perhaps otherwise would have considered a tracker because they didn't want to lock in for 2 years, perhaps this could work for them. So it's, you know, as with all decisions about how long to fix your mortgage at the moment, you have to make a call. But if you're convinced that rates are going to go down substantially by mid-2026, then could be worth looking at.
Lee, I don't remember what happened last week, but I remember what happened years ago, very in the early days of the podcast. You were talking about fixing, and you said about 2 years, almost blinking, it's over. 18 months. Life goes so quickly, you'd be coming round again to have to do it again. Ugh.
I guess the one thing I would say here that Halifax is trying to be a bit innovative in terms of, kind of thinking about what are its borrowers thinking about. And what they're thinking about is, are interest rates going to fall? And is that going to make mortgage rates fall? And instead of going on to an SVR, is an 18-month a good sort of stopgap option? But you're right. I still stick by that. 2 years just goes in the blink of an eye, you know, especially when you first buy a home, because by the time you've got you're settled in, you've done your decorating and mucked around and whatever it is that you're doing, you're kind of like, wow, those 2 years went fast. I mean, that's personally speaking. And then I took out a 3 year fix, and then I'll be honest, it's kind of had children and it all went in a blink of an eye again. And I was like, okay, we've now been here 5 years. So when it came again in 2021, I was like, do you know what? I'm just going to fix for 5 years. And actually it ended up being a very, very, very wise decision.
Yeah.
Where mortgage rates have gone. But, you know, it's, I always think in terms of mortgages and in terms of what banks are doing, it's good to have choice and it's good to have innovation and it's good not to sit still. So yes, I did describe it as a bit of a weird mortgage in the office, because it's weird because I've never seen an 18-month fix before. It's very short-term fix. And actually, I think there was a bit of a trend for like mortgage companies setting up for like really super long fixes, you know, because they'd argue homeowners want the stability of knowing how much, you know, a mortgage is going to cost over a long period of time. Well, this sort of throws that curveball the other way. So yeah, bit of a strange one. It might work for some people. It'll be a very small percentage of people that'll be able to access this anyway.
I ask this every time we have a weird product come out. They're obviously responding to demand. Demand is very varied at the moment. Are we going to get more weird stuff like this come out, do you think?
I reckon there could be more 18-month fixes, actually, because if you think about it, it would take you to what, middle of 2026. If you look at forecasts and predictions of where interest rates are going, you know, it's a kind of a little bit of a bet on where things are going to head next. The biggest gripe I have with it, though, and what you always have to do, whether you're buying a home or you're remortgaging, but especially if you're remortgaging, is how much the product fee is and all of that kind of stuff. So before you go all swinging for this, make sure that you're looking at what product fees are going to cost. So, I mean, it's cheap. The cheapest rate it's got is 4.37%, but it's got a £1,499 product fee. So that's pretty sizable. So you're going to want to make sure that you're factoring in everything. The true cost of a mortgage is a really important thing to figure out.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Dan Beecroft of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Dan, we have a reader question. If my pension is now liable for inheritance tax, should I spend it ahead of my ISA savings, and can my wife inherit it tax-free?
It's tough, because we'd really need to dive into the individual's financial details. For estates facing inheritance tax, the best approach really depends on the family situation, tax status, and how important inheritance tax planning is to them. So now, thanks to the recent autumn budget, things have shifted. So starting 2027, pensions will be included in the estate for IHT calculations. We're currently in a consultation period until mid-January, so it's wise to hold off making any major decisions right now. But the key point, spending your pension before your ISA could help avoid double taxation. Under the new rules, both pensions and ISAs will be subject to inheritance tax, and beneficiaries, like say for instance children, will receive them minus 40% tax. ISAs won't incur any further tax for beneficiaries, but pensions, depending on the age of death, might be taxed at the beneficiary's marginal rate. This creates this double taxation, this double hit. So first, inheritance tax, and then income tax when they withdraw from the pension. In the worst case scenario, that could mean an initial 40% inheritance tax, followed by 45% income tax for the beneficiary. That'd be an effective rate of tax of 67%. If the main goal is to minimize inheritance tax, then they might want to consider withdrawing from your pension, paying tax at your marginal rate, and then spending it, or better still, or even gifting the proceeds to future beneficiaries. This could be a tax-efficient strategy, especially if you're a basic rate taxpayer. Larger gifts from capital, say through the 25% pension commencement lump sum, could also be beneficial if you survive for 7 years. Can a wife inherit it tax-free? Absolutely. Thanks to the spousal exemption, any assets that you leave to your wife are not subject to inheritance tax, regardless of the value. Essentially, it means that your wife can inherit everything tax-free. However, it's going to be important to note that when the wife passes away, these assets will form part of her estate, and they will be subject to inheritance tax at that point.
That's great, Dan. Well explained. Dan Beecroft from Charles Stanley Direct.
Thanks, Lee.
Welcome back. In case you hadn't noticed, the weather has turned a little bit nippy. So how can you heat your home without breaking the bank? And is it time to fix your energy deal? But first, reader question time. I'm retired and spend most of my days alone in the house, mostly in the living room. I'm trying to avoid putting the heating on during the day to save money, but really feel the cold at times. I'm losing the winter fuel payment and need to keep my energy bills down. Would it be cheaper to turn the central heating on for a bit to warm up, or use a fan heater that I have to just heat that room? My house is a two-bedroom Victorian terraced and has no insulation apart from in the loft. My fan heater is 2 kilowatts and I have a 30 kilowatt combi boiler. I'm handing this one to you, Helen.
Can confirm I'm sitting with my heated blanket on right now. I do feel for this person because I really,
which by
really
the way, Helen, well. can I just say, which by the way, I have put on my Christmas list straight away after last week's show when you extolled the virtues of an electric blanket. I have reached middle-aged electric blanket Christmas shopping. It's warm socks and electric blankets. Thank you, Helen. Carry on.
I'm so happy for you, Georgie. It is so worth it. And I've also looked into the wattage of my electric blanket, and it is relatively cheap to run. So I'm happy. So I do feel for this reader. Obviously, I think this is quite a common question, especially with people, for example, working from home, maybe just sitting in one room. There's no one in the rest of the house, and they're thinking, oh, I don't really want to put the heating on for a few hours because that's just a waste, but I do obviously need to keep warm. And especially obviously, we heard this week that the energy price cap is going up again. So from January, average bills are going to be $1,738 a year. That's slightly up from $1,717 now. So it's something that's really on people's mind. Our Sam Barker has done some calculations for this person and worked out whether it is cheaper to use their fan heater or to stick their heating on. However, he's done this with some caveats, which are really, really important. So with all these questions, it's actually really difficult to run the numbers and really difficult to compare. So obviously putting your heating on, it depends on things like how many radiators do you have on, you know, how efficient is your boiler? There's so many different variables, and you know, how specifically do you feel the cold? You know, what's comfortable for one person isn't going to be warm enough for another person. So there are loads and loads of different variables to think about, I think, is the first thing to point out. However, if you do just look at the numbers, as Sam has done, it works out for this person that actually using the fan heater is quite a bit cheaper. So he's assuming this fan heater is an average 2 kilowatt model. That would cost 49p to run for 1 hour. That's if they're on a typical price-capped energy deal. However, running their boiler, assuming this is a 30-kilowatt boiler and it's 90% efficient, is going to cost £2.06 to run for 1 hour. So if you were only in one room, it would on paper be cheaper to use that fan heater than to switch the heating on. However, it is important to say as well, you know, putting your heating on regularly once a day maybe is important, especially if you live in an older property. It's a good idea to, you know, keep it heated at least reasonably well to avoid sort of damp, mold, those kind of things. So, you know, we're not saying definitely just sit in your front room with your fan heater all winter. You know, there's obvious reasons why that's not necessarily practical or a good idea. But, you know, on paper as a one-off, you know, I'm here today, I'm cold, I want to find the cheapest way to keep warm. Sitting in your front room with your fan heater is probably the cheapest way to go.
All right then, Lee. Smiling away there.
I'm smiling away because if Helen's going to dob on me and say I called the Halifax mortgage a weird mortgage, I'm going to dob on Helen in the office, because she just out of nowhere the other day started really going on about the virtues of a heated blanket. Yeah. I didn't realise that she mentioned it on the podcast last week, and she's mentioned it on the podcast now this week. And yep. I'm starting to wonder if she's just a shill for the heated blanket companies. You know, I can't believe
I hadn't
it.
Thought about that.
Yeah, it's I'm just mucking around, but I mean, the loving with the heated blanket is almost making me want to try one. And I'm currently sitting in a room. I'm currently sitting in my shed office, which is not plugged in to the central heating because of various planning things that don't allow you to do that. So my mum is classic mum, where she goes every birthday and Christmas, I don't know what to get you. Oh, you're just impossible to buy for. Even though I'm really not impossible to buy for, and will kind of give her numerous ideas of what to buy. Now, for my birthday, this is when you know you're getting old. She bought me a tiny plug-in heater for the shed office. And I thought, I don't know if that's going to work very well. But of course, now I got into the office this morning, I've got a thermometer in here. It was below 5 degrees in here when I started work this morning, you know, because even though it has insulation and everything in here, it's not the easiest thing to keep warm when it's very cold out. But the little plug-in heater is doing its job. And I've also got a little plug-in radiator in here and it's warmed it up to a toasty 18 degrees within sort of 2-3 hours, which I think is pretty good going, considering I'm basically outside in a shed, to the point where I've turned it off. But I think any way that you can make sure that you keep it warm, you know, heated blankets, whether a fan heater works for you, you've got to do it. But one thing I would say that's really worked for our house, that really can give your radiators another lease of life, that I think a lot of people don't do, is using thermostatic valves. Now, what they are, the modern ones are very good. They're usually numbered 1 to 5. Much better at controlling the temperature of radiators in each room. So typically in our house, it's really warm upstairs. So I have the thermostatic valves, even this time of year, on sort of 2s and 3s. Downstairs, it's typically a bit colder because it leaks a bit more heat. So I have them on at full blast at 5, but it's much easier to temperature control your rooms if you have the right valves, rather than those really old school ones that basically might have had all the markings faded off, or you just don't even know if they work properly. Well worth getting an engineer or someone to come and a plumber to come and sort out your valves if your radiators can take it. Honestly, life-changing.
I was just thinking there, Lee, I can see your mum's story there. I can raise that. So a parcel came the other day. My other half says it's a Christmas present for you. And we were sitting in the living room, and I was complaining that there was a bit of a draft. So all excited, he went upstairs and he says, "I'll give it to you now." Do you know what it was? It was a draft excluder. Was he actually seriously going to give me that for Christmas?
Georgie, what is it the kids say? That's giving me the ick. That's a red flag. That's a red flag right there. A draft excluder is not a present. That's just something you buy for practical purposes. You cannot pass that as a Christmas present. Oh my goodness me. I'm about to storm out of here to go and take a breather. unless it was like a novelty one, you know, we've got a draft excluder that's a big sausage dog. And actually, to be fair,
I'd take the sausage dog because I have a sausage dog. No, this was a literal draft excluder.
You've got a sausage dog. Just put the sausage dog in front of the door.
I've tried. She doesn't stay. I know. She doesn't stay. It's really annoying. I know. Earn your keep. But anyway, so there we go. I've just thrown my other half under the bus there. But it is a successful draft excluder. It is very, I have to say, it's. I don't know if I can extol its virtues as much as Helen can talk about electric blankets, but... You know, I'll see how that electric blanket goes, by the way.
Georgie, you can put on your Christmas list thermostatic valves. I mean, what could say Christmas and romance more than sort of than bleeding your radiators and
probably already got it.
Yeah, got it, mate. Completed it, mate.
You know, I wouldn't. Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait, Lee. Anyway, energy bills. While we're still on it, Helen, you mentioned there about how energy bills are going to go up again in January. So the question is it finally about time to fix?
It could be. For a long time there weren't any fixed deals available. It simply wasn't possible. Energy companies weren't offering them. There still aren't many around, but there are a handful. So we've looked at the 10 cheapest fixed energy deals that are around, and the most you can save, this is based on average energy use, is £140 a year. So you know, not a huge amount compared to an average bill of, you know, 1,700, but, you know, worth considering. So we've listed, if you go to the website and look at this article, energy bills will go up again in January, but households could save £141 by fixing now. We've got a rundown of those 10 cheapest deals that you could go for. It's also worth saying that it can be worth calling your energy company, because a lot of energy firms are offering sort of secret fixed deals. They don't advertise them openly, but if you're an existing customer and you call them, they might be able to give you a slightly sweeter deal than what's available out there on the market. There are some things to think about though. So a lot of these deals will have exit fees. So if you choose to leave before the term is up, say because the price cap goes down again, you realise that you're overpaying, you might need to pay £50, £100, and that can be per fuel. So that could be £200 to get out of that deal. So, you know, it can be worth considering, but I suppose similarly to what we're talking about with mortgages, you know, you're making a call on where you think things are going to go, and you know, you'll sort of be right or wrong. But I think with the sums involved, you know, saving of maybe £140-£150, it's definitely something that's worth considering. And also, you know, it just gives you the security that you know roughly what your energy bill is going to be for the next year or how long you fix for.
All right then, how much do you need to be stashing away for a decent retirement? It feels like a question that we ask a lot because it's really hard to work out, but there is a useful rule of thumb that you can employ to help you check if you are on track. And thankfully, it doesn't involve endless calculations or projections of what kind of retirement lifestyle you are hoping to achieve. So, Lee, what is the magic formula?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting one because, as you say, we do cover this topic a fair amount, and it's really hard to kind of get a real accurate gauge. But I kind of think sometimes these sort of like formulas and kind of like rules are interesting to sort of digest, acknowledge, and use as a very, very, very broad rule of thumb. We've got investment guru Gina Miller here advocating this simple check, which is basically as follows. So when you're 30, you should have your salary in a pension pot. When you're 40, you should have three times your current salary in a pension pot. Age 50, you should have six times your salary in a pension pot. Age 60, you should have eight times salary in pension pot. And age 67, you should have 10 times your salary at age 67 in a pension pot. That's pretty simple for people to get their heads around. So whatever milestone you are there, let's say you are 40 or coming into 40, how close are you to having three times your current salary saved into a pension? Now, I reckon there'll be a lot of people listening to this going, I'm nowhere near. And that's okay. You know, it's not like you, if you haven't got three times your salary in pension pot at age 40, that means you're going to have a terrible retirement and you're completely off track. You know, we were talking about difference between buying a house in 1974 to buying a house in 2024. I mean, you could make the same argument about something like pensions, where, you know, typically you had a lot of people on gold-plated pensions, which frankly don't really exist for our generation. When I say our generation, I'm talking 20s 30s 40s. You know, we are in a kind of different way of saving for our pension, and you know, whatever you've got saved in there, if you can save a bit harder into it, brilliant. But we have these things, these milestones that a lot of us try to hit, including buying a house, which we were talking earlier about the deposit required, that can end up draining out some money that would typically go into your pension. So for speaking for myself, I bought a home 8 years ago. I was saving into a pension, but I wasn't saving into a pension anywhere near hard enough as I would have liked to have been, because a lot of it was being directed into saving for a house. And I think a lot of people fall into that boat. But then since having a house, I have really ramped up my retirement planning and the amount that goes into a pension. So, you know, I'm between 30 and 40. Did I have one time salary saved into a pension pot age 30? I don't think I did. Would I have three times salary in my pension pot age 40? I might, is the answer to that, but I'm probably not going to quite hit it. But I'm not going to be completely out of the ballpark. You know, I'm not absolutely millions of miles away. But the other thing that we should point out with this is essentially, the formula is that it should work. The argument here is that this formula should work whatever sum you earn. So for example, if you're earning 30 grand at 67, you'll need 300 grand saved. But if you earn 70 grand, you'll need £700,000 saved. Now, the reason why I say that, it's assuming that you're going to then have the same lifestyle that you've got on your salary. So lots of us, we have different jobs that, you know, big bucks to, you know, just a typical average salary. It's a rule of thumb to make sure that you're going to have enough saved. And we've talked about this a lot on the podcast. I think as a generation of people that perhaps didn't save as hard into a private pension as what they would have liked to have done, mm-hmm. or simply just didn't really know about it. And that's where auto enrollment has been a kind of a good thing for our generation, because there's a lot of people that have hit retirement age, have had jobs and worked all their life and just haven't saved that much of a pension pot whatsoever. State pension will be fine. I've got my state pension. But that's not going to give you a lifestyle that you're probably accustomed to or wanted. You know, you don't want to look back and think, oh, I wish I'd just saved harder into a pension. But no, it's not as simple as that. You know, we have, you know, higher bills than ever before. As I say, saving for a home, having children, all of these things can mean a lot of money is drained out of what could have been headed into your pension. So what I would say is don't fret about it, but definitely worth just taking note of these kind of formulas. And there's others around the ladders of how much salary you should ideally have saved into a pension at certain milestones. And if you're listening to this and thinking, oh, it's miles off this, it's a bit of an audit. You know, just see where you're at and try and figure out if there's ways that you could potentially be adding more into your pension.
I always find this really hard as someone who's a freelancer to know what figure to use, because a lot of these assume that you're a salaried staff member and you're probably in a career where you understand, you know, what you should be paid and it's going to be quite consistent. How do you go about trying to work this out, Helen, if you're a freelancer?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It can be really tricky. And I think, honestly, even if you're a salaried worker, it can be tricky to know how much you need because, you know, those figures that we've talked about, the sort of 10 times your salary, that doesn't take into account the impact of inflation either. So, you know, if you're in your sort of 30s or 40s now, the amount you've saved in recent years could actually be worth a lot less by the time you get to retirement. And you know, the estimates that different people give are so different. So in this article as well, we've quoted RBC Brewin Dolphin, and they said that a comfortable retirement requires a pension pot of £630,000, which is a lot more than that £400,000. So, you know, it all depends on, as Lee said, the lifestyle that you're used to living, you know, how you sort of plan to live in retirement. Are you going to want to go on holidays? Are you going to want to, you know, are you happy to have quite a sort of relaxing retirement? Where are you going to live? What you know, are you still paying for your housing? Are you going to be renting? Are you still going to have a mortgage to pay? There's all kinds of sort of variables which make it really, really difficult. I think the key thing is really, as with so many things in our finances, just, you know, try and check in with it every now and then. Keep on top of where you're at with your pension and kind of think about the long-term plan, I suppose. So as Lee said as well, there's times when you might not be able to put a lot in. I, for example, bought my first flat a couple of months ago. I really haven't put a lot into my pension at all in the last few years. But my New Year's resolution is to, you know, check in with my pension, work out where I am, work out how I can potentially improve it. And they also say in this article, Daniel Hoff from RBC Brewin Dolphin, don't necessarily panic if you're getting slightly close to retirement age and you think your pension is falling short. He says, the good news is that those in their 60s often have spare cash to throw at retirement and can still make a difference at this stage because of things like, you know, once you reach 60, your kids might have moved out, you might have paid off your mortgage, and you do have a bit more to kind of put into it. So I think it's just thinking about where you're at now and planning for, could you save more in future? Are there going to be times that you might be able to save less? And I guess just being aware of where you are and where you're going with it, I suppose.
Some solid advice there, Helen. Right, Lee, my new SIM-only mobile deal is free. Alas, mine is not, but yours kind of is. However, you have a warning. Lee, what are you talking about?
Yeah, so I kind of think, you know, sometimes financial journalism, this podcast isn't reinventing the wheel. Sometimes we talk about things that lots of people go, oh, yeah, cool, people, I'm going to do that. But lots of people don't do this. So essentially, I was coming out of contract at my mobile deal, 24-month contract. And what a lot of people do is they leave it too late to shop around for another deal and or just kind of forget or whatever, and they just roll over and they carry on paying the same monthly amount, even though a large chunk of the bill is paying off the handset. And you now own that handset after your contract ends. And then all you've got to simply do is go onto a SIM-only deal, far cheaper than what your pay monthly deal would have been. But yet, people honestly waste hundreds of millions of pounds doing this every year. And a couple of things I've noticed before I wade into this, Georgie, as well, in terms of telecoms deals, so broadband, mobile, television, two things. First of all, we've got new rules that mean telecom firms need to show you how much a bill will rise using pounds rather than percentages. So you know, you get those adverts and it says this could rise by RPI plus 3.9% in April. And lots of people go, I don't look at that little small print, I have no idea what that means. They have to do it in pounds and pence. But actually, those pounds and pence charges that have now started to come out and be shown are typically higher than what it would have been if it was RPI plus 3.9%, which is quite frustrating in one. The other thing I've noticed, especially phone contracts, when I came to renew this, it basically started trying to push me onto a 36-month deal because it looked cheaper because you're spreading the cost for the long run. I wonder how many people go, oh yeah, actually I'd rather pay £30 a month rather than £40 a month, not being fully aware that overall they're going to end up paying more. It's just that it's stretched over a longer period of time. Some phone operators I've noticed are even offering 48-month contracts, four-year mobile contracts. Part of that will be because handsets have become so expensive. You know, we're talking plus £1,000 if you want real top range, top level latest handset. So look, typically a mobile bill will come in sort of two parts. You have the handset and you have the data and the calls. The handset I've just mentioned, but the data and the calls and texts typically now are just unlimited because we hardly use them. What's the important bit is the data and making sure that you've got the right level of data. So I weighed in and I got more data on my new contract than what I had before. So I was paying about £35 a month for free mobile. I opted to take a SIM only deal with Three Mobile at £11.20 a month on a 12-month contract. As I say, 12 gigs, absolutely fine. Now, it wasn't the very cheapest offer I found, but I just decided for sake of ease and not going to an operator that I hadn't heard of. Not that there's nothing wrong with going with some of these sort of plucky upstarts that have come up. And I did lots of digging around in reviews and stuff, and mostly pretty positive reviews, if I'm being quite frank. It's much easier to switch now and keep your phone number, which used to be the, remember all the pack code stuff and the nightmare it used to be trying to keep hold of your number. I've had the same mobile number for 25 years. I don't want to lose my mobile number. I love it. It's part of me and it's really nicely rounded, and I would have been upset if I'd lost it. But actually, one of the crucial reasons why I stuck with Three Mobile, and this isn't an advert for Three Mobile, I should point out, Georgie, if you're with any of the big networks, worth checking out what you can get from them. I got a 3+ membership, which is just like its reward thing. Now, usually these reward things are a bit wishy-washy or a bit rubbish. I never really buy into them. I don't really do anything. But with this, it was quite easy. It's just there's nothing to collect or anything. You just basically sign up to it if you're a customer. And every week they give you offers and deals and stuff. And every week that I've been a customer, first of all, they offer £3 Cineworld tickets for the weekend, which cinema costs have got pretty expensive. Makes it quite a cheap way to go to the cinema with my daughter. £3, I'll take that for the weekend. But the other crucial one is I get a £1 coffee every week at Cafe Nero. Now, I'm a big fan of Cafe Nero. Typically, I don't really like coffee chains very much, but Cafe Nero,
they're the best.
It's my cup of joe of choice, shall we say, if it comes to a chain. For £1, I mean, that's good. It's saving me £2.60 a week on a coffee I'm going to buy anyway. I go to Cafe Nero once a week, get my £1 coffee. That's £2.60 saved. Now, neatly, over the course of a month, that's basically now what I'm paying monthly on my new SIM-only deal, which wipes out the cost. So that's the way I'm seeing it. As I say, go out there, see what you can find with your operator and what they're offering, and make sure that you're not overpaying. That's the crucial thing. Just make sure you're not overpaying. It's a very competitive area, I would say, telecoms, but they rely on some people just falling out and overpaying when they don't need to be overpaying. I'm actually using the £35 a month that I feel like I'm saving, and I'm putting it into a regular saver. With Nationwide, 6.5%. Nice. Proper money journalist. I mean, the sort of thing that makes people yawn, shudder in their eyes, going, "You're doing what? That is so sad." But this time next year, Georgie, I'll be a millionaire. Now, this time next year, it will help pay for Christmas. And it feels, the reason why I'm doing it is because I've gone around, I've got off my backside, I found a smoky deal, I've not overpaid a drop of money. I'm getting my discount from my coffee, which I feel like is wiping out the bill. And it's given me a tangible incentive when it comes to this time next year, what is it, like behavioral economics or whatever, when I go, oh, that's a nice little bit of money I've got there for my Christmas spending. How many mince pies and pints of Guinness can I get with that money that I've saved up? Yeah, so it's...
But also remind you that money would have just been effectively wasted. It would be given to a company that doesn't deserve it. So if you kind of, not that you need it, but I think the rest of us do, that reminder that, wow, that what you could buy with the money that you just give to companies needlessly. Lee, I do want to ask, because basically you know how I like to do my financial admin when you're on the phone, because you inspire me. So I've just realised my mobile phone deal ends 21st of December. So when is the right time to start looking around? When can you get another deal? Does it automatically roll over? What are the rules and regulations, Lee?
Well, typically your provider will tell you that you're about to fall out of contract. So has your provider told you that you're about to fall out of contract?
It says I'm coming up to the end of it. Yeah, it's next month.
Yep. So what you want to do is you want to go and have a look at what they're offering you. Now, what a telecoms firm will want to do is to push you on to an upgrade, classic upgrade. Now, listen, I think smartphones, the technology on them, how can they get any better? The phone I've got right now, absolutely brilliant. I mean, could you have told me 10, 15 years ago that I'd be able to take proper quality photographs on my phone, that I could watch TV on my phone, that I could, with a touch of a few buttons, have a library of millions and millions and millions of songs? I mean, it's beyond my comprehension of a kind of late teens lead that is basically where we're at. So I never get hoodwinked into the upgrade. What I like to do is get a 2-year contract, and then I like to try and keep the phone for a further 3 years on a SIM only deal. It's
far too long time,
and it should last 5 years. The biggest issue is usually the battery, because we use them so much. But you want to go and see what they're offering you. Don't get hoodwinked into an upgrade if you don't think it's necessary. See what SIM only deals they're offering, and then typically, if you stick with the same provider, it's pretty simple, and you just sort of click through. And as I said, the SIM only deal with the provider you're currently on might not be as cheap as what else might be out there. So for that reason, go and comparison websites, go and have a look around, see what SIM-only deals you can find. If you're happy to stay with your provider but think that it's too expensive compared to what you can find elsewhere, I've always found it worthwhile giving them a call and saying, look, I want to stay with you guys. I've seen this SIM-only deal with this amount of gigabytes for this amount of money. You don't want to be as a customer. What can you do? And actually, typically, they do have a bit of leeway. And typically, they do tend to offer you the old classic loyalty offer, which is actually what I got with 3 Mobile. So the new SIM only deal was £11.40 a month, but that was with a 20% loyalty discount. So they might offer you a loyalty discount. There's no harm in starting to shop around, Georgie, and having a look around. And if you want a move provider, you just get your pack code. Make sure you don't cancel your contract, but make sure your new deal kicks in after your contract ends. Don't do the classic thing though and go, still got 3-4 weeks before I need to deal with this, so I'll just do it on the day, because that's when you might end up making like rush decisions and or get an upgrade and or go, do you know what, it's Christmas now, I'll deal with this in the new year. Then you end up
and then I never do.
And then you've overpaid for even a couple of months. It's annoying. So that's what I would say.
Brilliantly, great advice as usual. It is at this time of the podcast that we would do our usual, I say usual, we've done it once, but it will become usual, I assure you. Read a question time where we give away the This Is Money mug. I've yet to see this Is Money mug. Does it look good? Has it arrived yet?
It's proper nice, Georgie, honestly.
Is it proper?
If you saw it down Pitsy Market, mate, you'd go 10 quid all day. Yeah, it's lovely. Lovely stuff. Lovely. Right. Get your mugs.
That's what I want to hear. But, I mean, get your mugs, but not this week. Because this week, well, next week, actually, we've got the very, very special event for our 10-year anniversary. Lee, why have we not got a mug this week?
We're just busy preparing for the live podcast next week.
There you go. We're using all the questions for that.
and it sounds like a bit of a cop-out, but we want to make sure we get it right. And, you know, it's our New Year's resolution to get questions of the week properly set up and run. We've had some fantastic questions, and we will touch on some of them in the podcast, live podcast next week. So that's why we're just pausing it just for now. And then it's going to be more free-flowing, we promise.
And who's going to be there next week, Lee?
We shall have Sir Simon Lambert.
We shall have
the broadcast legend, that is Georgie Frost.
That's it, Lee, yeah.
The heated blanket-loving Helen Crane.
And with blanket, I hope.
And my humble self.
Oh, can't wait. And have all the tickets gone? Have we given them away to the people that wrote in with the reasons why they've been listening? Yep.
We've got a great audience. We're looking forward to meeting you. You guys are lucky enough to have got some tickets. It's going to be a lovely event. I think there's even canapes, which would be marvellous.
Goodness me.
That's the rumour.
So depending on how the event goes, it may be next week's podcast or it may not. Let's see how it goes. You may be able to listen. You may not. We'll tease you with that. But we will have a reader mug question I can't even say next week now, can I? At some stage. At soon. Some stage.
Soon.
Anyway, that is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Keep on asking your questions and you will hopefully win a mug if you've sent us a good one. And you can also comment in the article where this lives and can also tweet us at, or X us at thisismoney.
Wonderful. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.